Hello and welcome to the Flatland in Focus podcast. I'm your host, D. Rashawn Gilmore, and you may know me from our monthly show airing every Thursday on Kansas City PBS. Each month, we focus on a new topic impacting folks in the greater KC area, and we always end up with so many great questions from the panel of experts and community members that we assemble. So in this podcast series, we want to give you everything we couldn't fit into that neat 30-minute show. So this includes everything from Flatland follow-up as well, our audience conversation that goes live on Instagram every third Thursday at 7:30 p.m., right after our show airs. So join me. Welcome back to the studio for the roundtable discussion. With me today is Mindy Corcoran, founder of 7 Days and author of Healing a Shattered Soul, Rabbi Doug Albert, leader of Kol Ami, Congregation of Radical Inclusion, and Patty Davis, a social worker and program manager of trauma-informed care at Children's Mercy Hospital. And I really want to start with you, Mindy, and ask you, throughout your journey, and this has not been an easy 10 years, I imagine, right? But throughout your journey, what would you say gave you the strength to process your own healing from this significant loss?
Well, a few things really, too, that come to mind initially are my faith. My faith was extremely important to me. I immediately knew that my father and son were in heaven. I just had that knowledge. But also, I was raised by a physician who was extremely pragmatic. And I won't go into everything that he would say or do, but he was extremely pragmatic and a healer himself. So I happened to have that life experience and grow up with that. So I know that that was part of the catalyst to help me understand that I needed to heal myself to be able to help heal my family.
Can you take us to the moment where you realized that your life would forever be changed? What thoughts specifically, if you can recall, were going through your mind?
Well, I had two very specific moments. So initially, I found my dad deceased in the Jewish Community Center parking lot. So that was the initial moment of our lives have significantly changed. But you can't comprehend it in the two minutes or 30 seconds that you see it. And then I found Reet. I realized later that he had been shot. It took a while to understand that and comprehend it. But we lost him within 30 minutes of me finding him. So he lost his heartbeat in the ambulance. And the enormity of that hit, and you know it's enormous, but you have no idea the life-altering exponential changes that will happen. And it has been. It has been life-altering and exponential. And I know what we're going to get into, I think, is really important, because we had to heal ourselves, the three of us that were left, and then including my mom and brothers, but my husband, my son Lucas, and I, and we all healed differently. Mm. And Lucas was a 12-year-old boy. So there was all that nuances that we had to take into consideration.
And see, I think that's part of the challenge that we often don't really consider, Patty, that sometimes you can be directly influenced by what you see. You experience the trauma, the hurt, the pain, the tragedy, but you may not even be there and you can feel it similarly as well. And so I wonder what your thoughts might be on how, obviously Mindy was there and she's watching this happen, but there are others who are even outside of that, who are observing from a very different perspective even. How are we meant to process these traumas?
Well, with each other, I would say, is the first answer for that. We don't have to go through these things alone. So I love in hearing Mindy's story that she did that with her faith. That was the first thing that mm-hmm. she shared. So right away, she wasn't alone. And then she knew that her family was around her. And I know that she also had community connections as well. So we can process this. We need to talk about it. We need to talk about things that are upsetting and scary, maybe uncomfortable for others. We need to find the folks that we can talk about that with that will be okay hearing our story and hearing our hurt. And when someone goes through a tragedy, others are affected as well. And so finding those that want to connect with us and to keep that healing process going together can be really helpful. I loved Mindy's story. Just in the three persons she mentioned left in their family, they all healed differently. They all had a different process. Yeah. And that's part of the human experience. So we won't expect that everyone will have the same experience from the same event. And they're going to process that differently. And I think having that respect for each other and what they need and helping them get what they need when they need it is important.
I agree. And I just for me, Rabbi, I'm hopeful that you can put a little bit of a frame around how we go about processing these things. And specifically, in 2018, you helped to facilitate the vigil that occurred after the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting. What's the direct effect of holding that space for a community to come together, and what did it mean for you to be a part of that? And if I may add on, how does that impact, or how did it impact your work here?
Well, there's the very personal side of that experience, and then the very massively communal side of that experience. Right. And on the personal side, my wife was Pittsburgh born and raised. Much of her extended family still lives in Pittsburgh, very active in the Jewish community in Pittsburgh, so there was that connection. That was for Pittsburgh. But then I also thought, and I ran into Mindy at the parking lot there and thought about your experience and what took place at, well, it was such a violation of what Jewish community and Jewish Community Center is supposed to be. And I will tell you from a personal standpoint, if you go across from the main entrance and look at the plaque, it's my father, who was one of the lay people principally involved in building the campus. And he would have been horrified at such an event would have taken place there. But on a more communal level, I think it's both, as Patty talked about, coming together as community and sharing pain and sharing the trauma, even though we are all wired differently and we process grief in very different ways. So there is that part. And I think, Mindy, what you've done, which is what I think is just extraordinary and so much benefit to the community, is as you process your own pain and try and work through it, you also are reaching out to recognize the pain of others.
Sure.
And so I think about this because Passover is coming up, and we talk about our own experience being enslaved and in bondage, but the main message is about not oppressing the stranger in our midst because we know the experience.
Well, and I appreciate that so much because I think that's one of the challenges that we have in the world right now. And there's a lot of hurt, there's a lot of pain and anguish in the world. And it's not confined to any one corner of the world or any one race or group. It's just a lot right now. But it makes me want to ask, in response to what Rabbi was saying, Patty, how are we supposed to process these traumas? I mean, you said that people, much of what Mindy, her point, that people experience it differently. How do we process that trauma differently? And how do we tap into our own individual resilience?
I think that's a good question. I think it's something that we're really trying to continue to figure out today in the world of media being 24/7.
And is that part of the problem?
I'm going to throw out there that the exposure to trauma we know is a problem. The higher your exposure and the closer your proximity to trauma, we know scientifically tells us that's not helpful. And in today's world, when our children have these little TVs in their hands, so to speak, and they can see traumatic things so closely and oftentimes without their parent present. So thinking of having your child watch a scary movie and you're not even around to support them. So I think the exposure for some we're realizing is higher than it ever was. I don't know, and I haven't looked at the stats, if trauma, there's more of it today than there used to be, but I know that I hear of it more on a daily basis when I turn on the TV, listen to the radio. And I'm interested, but I'm also, as an adult, able to compartmentalize where I am. I'm in my car, I'm driving to work, I'm gonna go see my friend at work. I can think through all of those things. But a younger brain that isn't fully developed isn't able to do that as easily. So I do think there's an exposure to trauma that's higher than it used to be, and we're trying to figure that piece out.
So it's really an issue of both perhaps volume and frequency.
Absolutely.
Rabbi Alpert, of course, Mindy mentioned the role that faith played in her ability to accept what had happened and to begin to process it. What would you say to the viewer of this program who is struggling to, as this 10-year anniversary is upon us, whether they were there or not, they knew someone, or just knowing that it even happened, how does faith fit in with processing through trauma like Patty was just describing?
I think, one, it absolutely connects us as a community. And we immediately, if we are part of a faith community, we are part of a community. And when it's working as it should, which I think ours does, I know CORE does. I actually know this because my wife was a consultant for CORE too, so really familiar with the community. That you know you have a place to turn to right away. That said, how Jewish tradition, how Jewish law works through the grief process, it's a pretty specific kind of timeline. So no matter how you're feeling, and it makes room for however you feel, it's the first thing I tell a family going through a grief process is you get to feel however you feel. Mm-hmm. Nobody should tell you that you need to feel this way or that way. But it does give you a process by which to work through it. And the process is one in which first the community comes to you for 7 days. It's sitting shiv, it's the 7 days in your home. And then you are really compelled to go out into the community to say a specific prayer to mourn loss. And all that leads you kind of in a more healthy direction.
Well, and you actually teed that up for me just perfectly, because I want to ask Mindy about the 7 days and how the process of healing manifested for you and the work that you do now at 7 days and the strategies that you hope to bring to leaders in the workplace. Where I don't know what the exact stat is, but I would venture that a great deal of the trauma that we experience happens in the workplace or in public settings. It's not just in the home. How are you able to kind of help leaders to prepare, much less to cope after the fact?
Yeah, so thank you. Well, so 7 days, the foundation, we focus on training young leaders, so youth. We focus on our Kindness Youth Leadership Team and helping them become kindness influencers. So we have two channels specifically with 7 days, the foundation. And that is we pull youth in, they're high school students, freshmen through senior in high school. They're from all over the metropolitan area. And right now we're reaching 22 school districts, including—
amazing.
Thank you, including private and public and homeschooled. So we have a lot of variety of students that we're reaching. And so we pour into them and we we're offering them resources.
Well, I'm just curious, what is the response from students? Do they feel like it fits for them? Do they feel like it's applicable to their lives? And does it run counter, do you think, to some of the things that Patty was talking about that you see on social media, so much of this?
Well, the Kindness Youth Leadership Team that I'm speaking of specifically, they apply to be part of the 7 days Kindness Youth Leadership Team. So for some, whatever reason, their personal reason is, they have decided to apply. So that's our KYLT. And then we have a mentoring program for them from September through May. So that's how we work with those students. And we teach philanthropy, volunteerism, project management. We give them life skills. And regarding social media, we work with them on being kindness influencers. So a play on social media, mm-hmm. that we actually have had professionals come in and talk to them about what anti-Semitism in particular, mm-hmm. what anti-Black in particular will look like on social media, so that they start to understand it at a young age, instead of just going on with something, liking something, you know, hearting something, sharing something that they really don't understand. And we work to give them confidence in what they say and do on social media.
And so, and I don't want to exploit your pain at all. But talking about young people, adolescents who are trying to cope with trauma, they're signed up to be trained as kindness influencers and ambassadors, really. What is the message that you lost your son?
Mm-hmm. 14, he was 14.
Reed was 14.
And a freshman in high school.
And so many of us would say just entering just a really fantastic, new, somewhat scary phase of life, but the whole world is ahead of you.
The whole world was in front of him, yes.
And now you're taking that tragedy and your loss, your family's loss, your community's loss, and sharing that with students to help them be better. What is that like for you? Are there moments when you feel like, I would imagine, I'm really making the impact that I want to have, but then you step back and you maybe go, but it's from my own pain.
It's healing for me. It is a process of healing. I wanted something good to come from the tragedy. I knew my dad, you know, personally and intimately, and I knew Reet personally and intimately. I didn't know Terry Lamanno until later and who she was. But all three people who lost their lives were extremely good humans. They were already doing good things in the world, and they were all three going to continue. And so I felt immediately a responsibility and gratitude for what they had offered me in my life, and I wanted to be able to exponentially help other people feel that as well. So I will also tell you, selfishly, when my heart hurts, I know I need to be giving more. And that is what I do.
That is so beautiful, and it makes me, just as an individual, feel like there is healing for ourselves and healing others. Is that what resiliency is, Patty? I mean, because what I want to get at is, what are the ways in which we can begin to process, even identify the factors that really are impacting the trauma that we're feeling or have experienced, and how we work through it?
It is absolutely a part of it. So just like we have a ton of science to explain traumatic stress and traumatic exposure and what happens, we have a ton of science to talk about resilience factors and how we can get there and how we can build that up. One of the things that I talk a lot with parents when I'm meeting with them and their children is that in the medical world and other teaching facilities, they talk about see one, do one, teach one. And I feel like that's part of what Mindy is describing, is she went through her process, and I don't want to speak for her, but kids that I work with go through their process. We teach them the skill sets, and then they start to practice the skill sets. And then they want to teach others those skill sets because they want to give back to others that could be in pain from a different type of event. And that also heals them. There was a study many years ago where kids that were really scared from different things that had happened, maybe it was following a natural disaster in that town, maybe it was just different things that occurred. They did a study where they gave the kids little teddy bears as some type of stuffy and said, hey, little teddy bear, who whatever the name is really scared and needs lots of hugs and comfort. And that 4 and 5-year-old hugged the little teddy bear and gave that little teddy bear that support. And those kids that had that did better sleeping at night and returning to their baseline. So I think the fact of giving out to others is absolutely healing and is proven in some of those studies that we have.
So as I'm kind of compiling my own mental list of some of the tools and techniques that we can employ to help us to identify, and I think cope with is an appropriate term in the sense that we have to accept what has happened. And mm-hmm. part of the process of healing trauma is getting to a place of some degree of wholeness, right? Having support systems, caring adults, trainings, tools that help is a big part of that too. But so is the giving piece. And so now I turn to you, Rabbi Alpert, and I say, you know, we live in a time where, even if we think about the shooting in 2014, it came from a place of hate, obviously, and anti-Semitism that was in the heart of a really sorry individual, right? How do you talk about the realities of this kind of prejudice with your kids as you try to be a support for them? How do we explain to the folks in broader community, not only in your own family or own congregation, like, how does that work? What should that be in terms of a frame that we have as parents, as community, understanding what our role is in healing from this kind of hate?
It's difficult because we're prone to go to the negative. We're prone to say, here's what we are against. So we're against white supremacists. We're against neo-Nazis. That's easy in a way.
Yeah.
And we can all kind of come together. You know, good people can all kind of come together over that. But if we're not about what we're for, if we're only about what we're against, then I don't think we ultimately make progress. So I think part of the way you teach kids, teach other adults in my community anyway, is to kind of live what you're teaching. I mean, it's really, you know, so I'll give you an example. So one of the speakers at the Pittsburgh Vigil was a Muslim, Akhtar Chaudhry. He had recalled when he gave his talk that somebody in the Jewish community had come to speak for Muslims and said, this was back in 2017 at the Women's March, Kansas City version, and that's when they were threatening to register Muslims, and someone had said, if they start registering Muslims the way Jews once were forced to do, then meet and fill in the blank. And the blank was me. He didn't remember. It was I was the one who said it. And he quoted me at the Pittsburgh Vigil. So I kind of sheepishly got up and said,
that was me.
All of which to say, what I said in 2017 in support of Muslims, I didn't expect to get something in return, but it came. And I think if, by example, we start to stand up for each other, and again, it's getting outside of, not diminishing our own pain, but getting outside of enough to feel the pain of others, then I think that's when we start to make progress and live by example, whether it's the Muslim community, the Black community, the queer community, whatever community is marginalized, and say, I'm here for you regardless.
Patty, do you think that that goes to our sense of identity as individuals? Because some of what Rabbi Alpert was just saying to me really speaks to someone having a good sense of who they are, being able to tap in, like you said, Mindy, about your own faith. What is the role of identity in tapping into your own resilience?
Well, that's a huge part. I will say I work mainly with children, and they're still figuring that piece out, right? So the earlier we can help our kids have those resilience factors and teach them up with that love and that support and that comfort, it's going to be part of who they are, even if they haven't determined it yet. They're going to know when something difficult happens, they're going to be able to talk to their classmates in school, to their teacher. They're going to be able to go home and talk to their neighbors, and they're going to be able to have those conversations if that's how they've grown up and they've had those resilience factors around them. So yeah, it becomes who we are based on oftentimes just what we've been around. And then as we continue and we seek out, as we become older teenagers or adults, we start to think through, who do I want to be me? And how do I make those decisions? And we start to decide, is it going to be faith? Is it going to be with my community? Who are those folks going to be? And how am I going to give back? And then it becomes who they are. I think also people can alter and change when big things happen. So I've also seen a lot of great resilience factors built when someone maybe didn't think they had it in them, and they start to recognize, oh, wait, I can build up on this and I can help others, and I don't want anyone else to experience what I've experienced.
That actually brings me back to you, Mindy, because you have a great deal of experience in this area of helping folks to tap into resilience, and you've been showing others how to do it because you've done it. Earlier in the episode, we heard from Berkeley Selvin, and when you're talking about how connecting with you helped her put purpose to her pain, as she put it, how did you react to Berkeley reaching out, and what has that friendship meant to you over these ensuing years?
Mm-hmm. It's meaningful, and I'm very thankful that as a young woman, she reached out to me. So she was in college at the time when she reached out to me, and so she held that pain and that survivor's guilt without really experience or sharing it with anyone outside of her immediate circle and not understanding it. I had, another person involved during the day of when Dad and Reet lost their lives, there was another person who also felt survivor's guilt. And I don't feel like I can share specifically who that is and their story, but I didn't know that about this person until right about a year and a half later. We had lunch, and they let me know that they had survivor's guilt, and I was completely shocked. And I just said, I have no animosity toward you. I have never been upset with you about how anything went. And that released them, and I didn't know that I could help them release pain. And so that happened with this other adult. And then when Berkeley reached out with her pain, I immediately knew, well, maybe I can help release some of that pain with her. And she was very open, and we sat and had coffee and we cried together. And I said, you know, you are going to have a life and you have purpose, and, you know, turn it around. If you were gone and you could look back at us, what would you say to us? And she said, I would say, go have a life and have purpose. And I said, well, I'm forcing you to do that. I want you to find your onward, Berkeley.
Right.
And so she's working, and it's been really great. It's been amazing. She's just recently allowed herself to do any interviewing. And I'm really thankful that I thought of her as an option because I wanted to help her continue to find stair steps to her own healing.
Well, we're thankful for her as well and for being a part of the show today. And I'm kind of struck by the words of one Rabbi Alpert. And as we close the episode, I'm struck by what you said. It's really about how we treat the stranger and to know that you opened yourself up to Berkeley in that way and aided in her healing process and that of many others is absolutely profound to me. And I thank you on her behalf, although it's probably not my place. I'm just very touched by it. That's where we wrap up today's episode for Flatland in Focus. You've been hearing from Mindy Corcoran, founder of 7 Days, Rabbi Doug Alpert, congregation leader of Kol Ami, and Patty Davis, program manager of trauma-informed care at Children's Mercy Hospital. As we wrap tonight's episode, we remember not just a day of tragedy, but a decade of courage, of unity, and healing. As we reflect on the past, let us also look to the future with a commitment to peace, understanding, and resilience. It's all up to us. So be sure to watch our special Healing Hate episode at KansasCityPBS.org and find the rest of our reporting on this very topic at FlatlandShow.org. I'm D. Rashawn Gilmore. This has been Flatland in Focus. And as always, thank you for the pleasure of your time. You can watch that panel discussion with our accompanying documentary reporting on our website at flatlandshow.org. And we continued the conversation in our Flatland follow-up that takes place on Instagram after each episode premieres. This gives our audience an opportunity to ask the questions we didn't have time to address in the show. And in case you missed it, here is that dialogue. For those of you who are just joining, I should introduce myself. I'm D. Rashawn Gilmore, and I have the privilege and pleasure of being the host of Flatland in Focus on Kansas City PBS. And I hope that many of you joined us just a few minutes ago for the most recent installment of our once a month show, really talking about a traumatic incident that happened in our own community. But I want to broaden this conversation out quite a bit. I'm privileged to be joined by my colleague, Mary Sanchez. And Mary, for many years, wrote for the Kansas City Star and was a very stellar journalist there, and I think we're very fortunate to have you at Flatland. How long have you been with? It's been 2 years now, Mary.
I think a little over 2 years. Yeah,
a little over two. It's just I feel like I'm always made better by the people I get to work with at Flatland. And Mary, I think we should probably just jump right into this.
Okay.
You know, on the episode tonight, we were talking about an issue, an event that happened in our own community 10 years ago, a deadly shooting outside of the Jewish Community Center, and three people, you know, lost their lives. And having the daughter, who is also the mother, daughter of one victim who lost his life, and then the mother of another victim who lost their life, and the work that she's doing and how that has helped her to process her own grief and trauma. Before we talk about healing from trauma, Mary, I'd like to ask if you could do a little bit of a level set for us about what actually happened that day.
Okay. Well, we're talking about April 13th of 2014, and this is oftentimes now referred to as the Jewish Community Center shooting. When I wrote columns, I used to say that a known white supremacist slithered up to Overland Park. And I still feel that way. He is deceased. We don't say his name because you don't need to glorify that. But it was a horrible day for Kansas City, just Kansas City wide. He came up, he had been scoping out where he might possibly murder Jewish people.
And he had been doing that the week prior, too. I think that there were several stories about him having really laid out this plan.
It was a plan. He lived in southern Missouri, and he had been known somewhat. My former colleague, she's still a Kansas City Star, Judy Thomas, knew a person. He was older. He had been in neo-Nazi things, in Klan, had gone, I can't remember what groupings that those the white supremacist groups tend to morph quite a bit. The Klan is kind of old school. Then it went to Black patriot groups, all sorts of different types of identities, but a lot of it kind of harbored the same sort of anti-Semitism was broad, homophobia, you know, very anti-immigrant, that kind of a mindset. So he came up, but definitely wanted to, his plan was to attack Jewish people. So he thought the Jewish Community Center in Overland Park would be a prime spot. So mm-hmm. he there and was able to shoot and murder two people. Mindy, who you had on the show, it was her son, 14-year-old Reed, and her father, Dr. William Corporon. He was a medical physician. And then he was able to drive out and go to Village Shalom. And because of the name Shalom, it's a nursing center. And he killed Terry Lamano there. And this is all with guns, shotgun, in the parking lot. The thing that always struck me is that, you know, Terry is Catholic and the two other victims were United Methodists. And it, because our Jewish community has been so open and frankly welcoming in the Jewish Community Center, so many people, I have friends who send their children there for daycare, for all sorts of programming. It is very much a hub and a home for many members of our Jewish community. But the fact that he would go there and then wind up not finding Jewish people, they were there also. I mean, that's part of what we wrote today. But to me, that just says something about our population here, everything that they've offered to the greater Kansas City area for years.
Well, and I think that's, I mean, you hit several things. I want to kind of pick at them one by one. And for our audience, I do want you to know that we're going to move the conversation to the healing from trauma part of it. And I will stipulate that Mary and I, neither of us are mental health experts in that way. And we do hope to be joined by one such person. But we can speak from our experience and our observations. And I think that that's relevant, too. But you mentioned several things. One, obviously, this guy chose these locations because he wanted to inflict maximum harm on a group of people that he felt needed to be punished, right? Or he felt were, I don't know if he had a manifesto as such, but some of the things that were conveyed around him, but it was about he wanted to hurt and harm and kill Jewish folk. But this was an older person. Yeah. Can you share your thoughts, Mary? Because I know growing up, I always thought, felt, hoped, believed that it's really just this older generation that hold these anti-Black or anti-Semitic or anti-immigrant or anti-LGBTQ and everybody. I thought that that was going to die off with age and time. I hate to be so grim, but that was what I thought. But it doesn't seem like that's the case when we have groups like Patriot Front and others that are really doing their best to inculcate this sort of hatred into the minds of younger people. Do you think things have gotten better or worse? As I look at one of the comments here in the chat and somebody says the anti-Semitism has soared since then, but I think that's only one of many reasons.
Yeah, it has soared. Anti-Semitism, and I'm stealing words from Gabrielle Gellert, who leads the JCRB here, Jewish Community Relations Bureau. And, you know, anti-Semitism is centuries old. It morphs, and these are her words, and I do this, it's correct. It morphs and shifts and changes a little differently through time than other targets. You can, you know, there's often a new targeted group. Immigrants have long been one, and Jews have been long one, but theirs is really centuries old. So it has the ability to kind of almost shift through time and space. That's maybe gives it a little too much credit, but
it's very determined not to die out. I mean, it keeps feeding itself.
It keeps almost reinventing itself. Yes.
There we go. Yeah.
And that's part of it. I do believe in younger people. As much as I was very privileged in my career to just come on at the right time and have wonderful connections, and that I met a lot of the great civil rights leaders of the 50s and 60s before they died, and was able to, you know, interact and interview them for many stories that I wrote for the Kansas City Star and then also from Tribune Media. That generation did tremendous things. I do think younger populations are far less willing to put up with some of the things that maybe other people let pass.
I would agree with that, definitely.
You know, do think things are changing and shifting in many ways, but you have just this prevalence of people who still feel like they need to, or they believe horrible things about Jewish people or about immigrants or about gay and lesbian people. That's kind of a human condition that is, and this speaks to Mindy's work, can be almost, you have to learn to hate.
Right.
But National Conference of Christians and Jews I used to do programming with them for high school students. That's what was one of their slogans. And it's very true. You know, you can, if a young person isn't nurtured, and this gets into some of our healing and the trauma and research, you know, if you're not nurtured and loved yourself, do you know how to nurture and love? Yeah. And are you then more susceptible to a message about the problems that you're feeling, the loneliness, the insecurity, the whatever, you can't get a job? That's because of this group or that person. And you can kind of twist it. People, unfortunately.
But you just hit up on something really interesting to me. And I talk about this a lot in the talks that I give around race relations, whether within the LGBT community or outside of that. And one of the things that has always just sort of mystified me is this, and I say it a little bit differently than you, but I think it's sort of the inverse of it, but it's kind of the same thing, which is to say that hurt people hurt people. And so somebody who feels like it's that other group over there. And it just seems like so many of the conversations or the mentalities that we hear being discussed and shared, these ideologies really are centered on the fact that if you have a problem in your life, it's those people over there who are the cause of it. It's those immigrants, those blacks, those Jews, those this, that, the other. And to me, it just feels like, and I'm just throwing this out there because I would love to hear your take on it. It just seems to me that when we have not really addressed the most meaningful problems that we face as a society and not address them in a way that it takes away this frame of whose fault is it. And I'm not saying that there's not plenty of room and time for accountability. There's definitely that opportunity. But the notion that we want to scapegoat, as one of the commenters said here in the chat, that we want to scapegoat these other groups. I mean, thinking about this man, whatever he felt was wrong in America or wrong in the world, he made up his mind that day that it was the Jews. And so I got to go get the Jews and I got to show them. Okay, so this person is obviously broken. How do we take somebody? And again, this is probably a bit unfair because I know you and I are not mental health experts, but how do you take somebody like that and help them to heal? I mean, we're the most carceral society and carceral nation in the world. You know, we imprison more people than anybody. You're not going to get it there. Is it society's job then to bring these people in and try to, you know, rehabilitate them? Or is
at what level? I mean, this man murdered three people, cold-blooded, there was no remorse. I mean, I attended the trial, no remorse at all, none. Zero.
At no point, there was never even at sentencing, there was never a moment where it was like...
That wasn't his thing. He was tried in capital murder and put away for life and then died. So that's gone there. Mindy did a program a number of years ago through her 7 days.
7 days, right.
And it was actually, I think they said it was one of the highest attended of their large events. Like 800, more than 800. I remember being there. I'm trying to remember the person's name. It was a man and a woman who had both been within like a neo-Nazi group, a white supremacy group. I'm remembering his name and not hers. Anyway, they do tours and talks. And the conversation was very much around how they had entered those groups. You know, what was lacking in them? What were the other forces? The movie American History X, I always
Oh my God, that one, yes.
That from what I haven't recently, but I used to spend quite a bit of time around militia groups and these other groups and unfortunately the people who they had harmed and did, you know, many stories that way. That movie really hits with me as a truth. The reason though, these two were sat down with Mindy is that they had seen the other side. And they were meeting people about the mistakes that they made in life and about how can we not somewhat force people, not force, but guide people into those groups. How do we keep them from latching on? And the woman I always remember that you always spoke a lot about how there's a lot of sexism in the groups, that the women often get abused.
Mm-hmm.
And that's some of that, you know, stereotype-wise of the male bravado and this is who you are,
yeah.
That's a strength. They were really good about kind of showing a fullness of why some people become attached. And, you know, you can look at even things like anti-immigrant groups, anti-government, somewhat that. You know, and it's not so much an initial target against, say, immigrants or someone else, but it's an anti-government. It's the government doesn't represent me. I don't have to pay taxes. I oppose someone taking my land, taking my guns. You remember Waco. Sometimes they'll be based around a religious ideology, but it's all about identity, which kind of gets to where we were.
That's where I wanted to go to, the identity piece, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, we used to call them Christian identity groups. It was another group, another splinter of these factions that have tried to target others for their strength.
But doesn't that mean though, that if, okay, so this is really good. So doesn't that mean,
yeah,
just if we just sort of extrapolate that out, doesn't that mean then that the hardest part, and then we're talking about the one side of healing from trauma, and that's the people who have the issues who are inflicting this harm. But it seems that because these ideologies have become so bound to their identity, that's why it's harder for them to even move away from it, because then they've got to look in the mirror and ask themselves who they really are. Like, am I really this person who was taught this hate? Am I really this person who was taught that these other people are, I mean, we literally have right now one of two presidential candidates, one of the major party presidential candidate who shall remain nameless, you can figure it out on your own, who is using the words of Hitler in describing Jews and others, but especially Jews. They're using that language today to describe immigrants. And I think the people who are so supportive of this particular candidate and their politics are really rooted in their identity, while they're looking at everybody else saying, oh no, it's you queer person, you're trying to focus your identity, or you Jewish person, your identity, or you black person, your identity. They're not looking at their own identity and how their ideologies and the ideologies of whiteness and white supremacy have really just sort of been inculcated in their brains, if you will. And I think that, and I don't know if you agree with this or not, but I think that's why it's so hard for them to even move toward looking at life and other people differently, because they see themselves and their identity and the ideologies that uphold that as being preeminent.
Yeah. Well, I think anyone, identity is important. And as part of what we wrote this week, it can be a healing factor. It's a resiliency factor.
Sure.
If you have a strong sense of identity and who you are, what you stand for, that's all for the good if your identity is baked into the idea of a positiveness and a positive yourself and a lovingness towards others, and not a sense of identity as in I'm better than anyone else, or that I need to put someone else down, a group down, in order to maintain my identity. That's where it gets a little but the human kind of preponderance is to want to identify with a group, but like goes to like for some reasons that are not all bad. It's a sheltering.
Fair.
A lot of African American people, Latinos, and actually I think I say this as well, you know, during COVID, some of the lockdown remote work was good for some groups.
Yes.
Because deal with some of the pressures that they felt if they were perhaps the only person like themselves with a particular within their workplace. And it just made work a little bit better. We have seen more long-term, people need people.
Yes.
And people who are different from you. We learn from them. So, you know, how do you manage all of this is all of it.
Right. Because, okay, so For those of you who are just now joining us, you're watching Flatland Follow-Up with DeRashawn Gilmore, host of Flatland in Focus here on Kansas City PBS, and I'm joined by my esteemed colleague, the prolific and preeminent writer, and that to call you a writer is to do you a great injustice, but Mary Sanchez is a phenomenal writer and columnist, and really, I look at you as a repository of so much Kansas City knowledge. And so I want to shift a little bit. We're talking about healing from trauma, and we had on the show tonight several guests, including Mindy Corcoran, whose life was turned upside down when her father and son were murdered in cold blood by a white supremacist ideologue 10 years ago on April 13th at the Jewish Community Center. And as we shift to talk about the healing from trauma part, I think it's important that I say something that I think sometimes we feel like we shouldn't have trauma associated with events that didn't necessarily happen to us, or we weren't directly affected, or we weren't there to observe it. But I kind of come from the school of thought of Dr. Joy DeGruy, and that's capital D-E, capital G-R-U-Y. Dr. DeGruy wrote a book called, and she coined the term, post-traumatic slave syndrome. And several years ago, UMKC brought her in. Dr. Susan Wilson, vice chancellor at the time, was doing great speaker series. They brought Dr. Joy DeGruy in, and she talked about 9/11 and the impact of trauma, and how there were people who were in the towers or right there in New York, you know, and they survived, and how they processed the trauma and experienced it was very different from some people who weren't even there, but who, and I don't have the appropriate clinical terms, so I'm going to beg the audience for some forgiveness here and some grace, but there were people who weren't even there. They watched it on TV, and it had a different, and in some cases, a much deeper traumatic effect on their lives. And she also went on to say that, and I mentioned that because I think there's some people who are like, you know, maybe you weren't there that day. Maybe you're not in the seat that Mindy was in, or you're not a member of the Jewish community in Kansas City or anywhere. And maybe for you, it didn't hit you the way it hit somebody else, but somebody who wasn't even there, it hit them. And so I guess I'm getting at this notion of sometimes trauma hits us in ways that we don't even expect it to. You may be watching what's happening in Palestine right now. You may be watching what's happening, you know, the series of earthquakes, other natural disasters. You're not there, but that trauma hits you. And I guess I just want to say to people that you don't have to experience it directly for it to be very real to you. Yeah. You just have to be a human being.
Well, two things. One, to kind of differentiate between where we started, what happened 10 years ago, and frankly 9/11 as well, was terrorists. They were hate crime. It was hate crime towards the United States, and hate crimes towards the intended target was Jewish people.
Jewish community.
The definition of a hate crime is, and terrorism is, to terrorize beyond just the initial. It was a message that was being sent 10 years ago to the entire Jewish population here, that you are not safe, that someone would like you dead. The power of it is beyond the three lives that were just taken, which is horrifying enough.
Sure.
So there's that. That's an aspect of what is a hate crime. It is intended to send a message to an entire group of people, whether they were even in the vicinity, whether it was even realistic that they might be harmed that day or not. It's a broader message.
To keep you in a state of perpetual fear.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Trauma, as it's just trauma, one of the things that we wrote about in the piece, and that Dr. Denise Dow from Children's Mercy was just incredible with myself, including my other colleague the other day, and really unwinding. And you had Patty Davis on the show tonight. She's also an expert.
She was phenomenal, yes.
Wonderful. People, and they're very good at really understand, you know, explaining in layman's terms what trauma is and trauma isn't. And we've tended to use the term trauma so prolifically in American society, largely for the good, because we're much more open. And this is a good thing about younger people. They speak of how they feel, their emotions, where they are in many ways. But things that are really trauma have to be a perceived or real threat to your life and limb, is how I wrote it in the piece. to your real like life. That's a much deeper, graver level than sometimes it's used.
Yeah.
But that's a little bit of a difference. But one of the things that Mindy also said, I had a long conversation with her right after the shooting, after the chief spray. And she was rethrown into some of her own trauma just by hearing about it. And that's in another
Very triggering.
But she also made the comment that, you know what, anyone who was there, and I was there, I have a close family member who was there very close to the scene of where people were harmed, and Lisa Lopez Galvin lost her life. You don't even, I almost hear myself break up now. It sent a message, and that reverberation of the event was larger on many people in Kansas City society.
Absolutely.
That's kind of a traumatic incident, more so for the people who are right there, but it kind of sends that message of your fear of a random bullet could just end my life at any moment.
Well, and that's kind of the point. And I'm so glad you said that. I think the point of that, and I'm glad you gave us that sort of breakdown and the distinguishing between trauma and terrorism and trauma. I guess it feels like, and I speak as a person with multiple intersecting identities, and at a place and time in society and in our politics and just the state of the world where any one of them could be just cause for somebody to want to, you know, make me or somebody like me a target. You're a Latino woman. I'm a Black man and a gay man at that, and I'm very visible and vocal. I guess what I'm getting at is this. Is it possible, and this may be too big a question for either of us to answer, but it is worth asking, is it even possible to heal from trauma when the purpose of these terroristic actions and the repetitive nature of these traumas is designed to keep you in the state of perpetual fear, anguish, terror? And if it is possible, and I welcome any comments or questions from the audience, but if it is possible, how on earth do we begin to take up that journey, that healing work? Just your thoughts on that, Mary.
Well, not an expert. I can peg into a little bit of what the experts told me.
Sure, yeah.
Part of the first thing that I would say is define healing, and healing's going to look different for people. I've long stopped writing about people finding closure from horrific events.
Say more about that. I feel like that's very pregnant. Well, I want to hear you break that down a little bit.
People, you know, healed as if it never happened. She lost her father and her
son, 14 years old. My God.
It changed everything, the trajectory of her life. I have a very close friend of mine who lost a sister in a murder. It changed the trajectory of her whole life and her whole family's life, and in some ways mine.
Sure, yes.
I see her right now. It's been 25 years now. But you learn, though, what you can learn is how to cope with that brought to you, and how to cope with the feelings and emotions, how it affects you and where you place it. And there's so much about science, and this is what was really interesting about, you know, doing this work, is that the science speaks to the human adaptability, that we are bred to be resilient. Bred might be the wrong word, but we're as a biological being, we are adaptive to trauma and to stress. And how Dr. Dowd said it to me was, think about almost like weight training. The stress and the pressure is actually what makes you stronger. That can be true in instances of what we would call trauma. Identity is a huge protective barrier. So that was interesting about the two young women that we profiled in this piece was Berkeley.
To Berkeley, but yeah, okay, go ahead.
Then Rachel is another young woman who was also there upstairs in the room. There was a group of young Jewish girls who were part of their group that were meeting that day, and had circumstances been a little different, they would have been within the path and obviously were the intended targets of the shooter that day. They both struggled quite a bit with survivor guilt, but also just this sense of who they are and what it Jewish women. And they both are more, they said, grounded in that identity of who they are. And it was just an example of what there's been studies that show that, that it, that's a resilience builder. When you,
you know, it's
who you are and you know what you stand for and you know your community in that positive way and faith. Mindy's original organization was called Faith, it was Faith Always Wins Foundation, and they've shifted through time through many different reasons, but that the word faith led everything, even though she questioned God deeply at points.
Well, we talked about that on the show tonight, on the panel. I mean, having Rabbi Albert there to talk about, you know, the role of faith and being able to provide a source of strength and a foundation from which to build upon. But you gave me something, and I hope at least that the rest of the audience grabbed this too, which is that maybe we have to transition our thinking about trauma and transitioning what we think about it in terms of healing being some destination that we arrive at versus coping with it. And coping versus healing, it almost sounds, or could sound to some like, well, that's not a complete process, or that it's a cop-out in some way, but it's really the truth of what life is. Rarely, I don't know if anybody out there has ever had an injury as a kid. I have a scar on my hand now. I fell off of an ATV riding four-wheelers up the mountains of Costa Rica last summer. Now, healing, I guess, if I think of the way most of us think of it, is it's gone. There's no memory of it. But it's a process, and this scar reminds me of that experience. It doesn't hurt the same way, and I know what to do if it does hurt. I have this mark that's the evidence that I went through something. But I think maybe the shift that I'm trying to see if you agree with is that we have to change our mentality about what we think this is. Because again, you look at somebody like Berkeley, who was just, you know, it could have been her. And I know she lives with that. She lives with that. And then, as you mentioned, the survivor's guilt. But I also feel like for those of us who sometimes approach these things and think, well, because it still affects me the same way, or because I'm triggered, I'm not healed. And I think we've gotten healed, and healing, it's told us that there's some magic destination to where this thing that happened to me doesn't affect me anymore. And we're over time, but this is a good conversation. And I knew we would be, but I don't want to stop just yet. So
yeah, that's not realistic really though, because it did happen. There are therapies, and Mindy's family has been through that, some of it, to help you. She had some real specific, she said it to me in an interview, so as you can say it, it's EMDR, but without explaining that, it's a type of therapy, but it does get into brain science, everything that all of this is kind of coalescing together, what we know about the human body, what we know about the human brain, what we know about what happens in our bodies when we're fearful, that fight, flight, the cortisol, all that stuff that you've heard about. This all plays in to our understanding of how we can think of these issues and think of our own human abilities to manage really awful situations, or maybe things that aren't as steep, in just a more positive way. She had those, Mindy felt, because she was the last family member to be with both her father and
Reed,
when they were still living, particularly Reed. She got there that day. Her and Lucas were coming. It was raining, and his lacrosse game had been canceled, so they were going to try and come and meet. Reed was going to do an audition for a talent show that is still held every year. Mm. So she pulls into the parking lot right
there.
Yeah, pretty much after. But because she felt that there was an almost a duty, and this is my own words, but to hang on to those last minutes of life that she saw with them, a very traumatic scene to have witnessed as a mother, as the daughter.
I can't even imagine.
hanging on to it in a way that was harmful to her, that was reinstituting that harm and maybe re-ingraining it. That's my words. I'll probably guess, you know, when the scientist tried to say that or the therapeutic way. But she did it and get some help to be able to see it differently, manage it. It took away some of the, it can still really deeply hurt her.
But, well, yeah.
But she was able to do it, to not have this image in ways that were immediately harmful to her. And we know about brain science that there are those types of remedies and helps for these kind of severe trauma instances.
Well, I have to tell you, the
positive. It's a lot of the shifts is to think of people not as broken, but as something that happened to you. And you don't even in your verbal, 10 years ago when I first started writing on, I tried to do a project when I was still on some of this, was one of the first things I can remember, the people at St. Children's Mercy again, and some of their new research was saying that you adults cause some of the problems more long-term with children who have undergone something horrible. And when they're trying to help
absolutely
speak to them as a victim. We're so sorry. Oh my God, this happened to you. And no, you know, and they mean the best.
Sure.
Instead of building up that child from what are your unique strengths, instead of reaching to whatever it is about that child that got them through that, that we can build on that and really
tapping into their own resilience.
Yes. It kind of sounds simple, but it's going to the positive, not the negative, without denying. It's not Pollyanna denial.
And that's the key distinction. It's that, and you said this, you can't deny because it did happen. And I think a lot of times you want to ignore it, forget about it, wash it out of our minds. And I'm not saying that we need to dive into it every day of our lives either, whatever those traumas may be, whatever it may be. But I do think that that is part of the challenge that most of us have. And you know, one of the things that Dr. DeGruy mentioned in her research, which I found so compelling, was that not only has there been research that shows that Holocaust survivors, that they're, it's like the DNA markers almost change and it gets passed down because of that trauma. And you see that with survivor descendants of enslaved people, enslaved Africans. You see it with Jewish folk who went through the Holocaust, or their immediate ancestors, you know, their mothers, fathers, grandparents went through the Holocaust. I mean, that kind of thing does not go away, but it's how we approach dealing with it and how we, as you just said, tap into our own resiliency. And I just want to say to our audience tonight, I know that, you know, our plan was to have a mental health professional, and said you got two mental cases, but I say that because I know Mary will let me get away with a little bit, but we care about these issues. And I will just say that if you have an opportunity and you're looking for support, or if you want to learn more about the Jewish Community Center, I want to say massacre because that's what it was. I know that we say in this country, if it's for, it's a massacre in my mind because of the hate that fueled it and the hate that it proliferated. I do just want to say, sorry, technology doing what it does. I do just want to say that at our website, flatlandshow.org, you can find some additional reporting and resources from our very stellar reporting team about not only this particular incident, but the issue more broadly. And I do hope that folks like Patty and the great work that she's doing, because I know we talk about it in the framework of children, but there are a lot of unhealed traumas or traumas that people aren't coping with in a lot of adults. And as we see things unfold in the world, I do just want to say, because I know I'm going to get some pushback. Well, you're talking about this incident that happened 10 years ago. What's happening right now in Palestine, this and that. Listen, let me just say something to you. Two things can be true at once. Okay. We can care about multiple things at once. Okay. And so in this case, what happened 10 years ago in our community and the impact that it had on the lives of people directly and indirectly, that trauma is still showing up for people. I'm amazed by Mindy. I had one question that I was sitting there in my chair moderating the panel that I was really fighting myself. I feel like I could have asked Mindy. In retrospect, I probably could have, but I couldn't in that moment because she was just being so transparent and so real, so forthcoming. But it was this: what above all else was it important for you to either say to Reet, your son, or hear from him in those final moments? I didn't ask that question. And she kind of touched on it a little bit in one of her responses, but I only bring that up here now to say there will always be unanswered questions. There will always be aspects of this that we don't understand, but that shouldn't be a barrier to seeking greater reconciliation, greater understanding with one another, and to challenging ourselves, challenging those that we love, to pursue a course of healing, which in my mind now today, thank you, Mary Sanchez, is about how do we cope with our traumas. Mary, I want to give you the last word before we close out this Flatland follow-up. And I knew that we were going to go over because it's me and you, and I was just not, I just knew, but I'm glad that we did. Mary Sanchez, the last word.
Well, you know, Mindy has answered that.
Oh, at least, okay.
What she, I mean, she didn't need an answer. She said that she heard a voice and she believes this. She will see her father. It was that your father is already in heaven. Go to Reet. And then later.
She did say that. Yes, yes.
That Reet and her father are in heaven. They see signs all the time. A yellow butterfly. A yellow butterfly is Reet. Their whole family sees Reet that way. Mm-hmm. And you can, you know, however people want to believe, if they believe in an afterlife or not, but there is a sense of peace and calm with that for her, within identity, within connection. They had no lack of love or unfinished business other than his life. But loved him and she loved, you know, that is so grounding for people.
Yeah.
It's not that you don't miss them and you don't have the sorrow, but that's part of resilience.
Actually,
that baseline of a strong family, and it's not like their family hasn't been through hell and really suffered struggles. But there, when she left that taping, we taped last Friday. When she left that taping, just for your audience, and then it aired tonight, she was rushing to get out of camp. Yes, studios, because she had 40 family members coming in for a huge family reunion the rest of the weekend. Mindy was surrounded by the love of her family, and they held some of it at Church of the Resurrection.
Well, you know, Mindy's example really is that to tell those that you love them, and to surround yourself with those loved ones. And this is one of those issues that there was no way in 30 or 45 minutes we'd be able to fully address it. But I do hope that the conversation has been instructive and informative and encouraging for our viewers tonight. This particular Flatland follow-up will be available on our page here at Flatland, at Flatland on Instagram. And I just want to say that if you're out there and you're struggling, please get help. Please. If you don't know where to go, I'm so glad that we're going to have 988 and it's getting really underway in this area. But please visit our website. Again, as I said, flatlandshow.org. And if you want to watch the episode, if you didn't see it, certainly go to our website or go to YouTube and just search Flatland KC and you'll find this particular episode. I want to thank my colleague, Mary Sanchez, for joining me tonight for the Flatland follow-up. And to all of you for watching, for contributing, for being a part of this. We are so thankful for this time with you because we get to be a little bit freewheeling. And so we went over time a bit, but I'm very grateful. Mary, thank you for your time tonight. Thank all of you for joining us. Bye-bye now.
Thank you for listening to the Flatland in Focus podcast. Tune in again next month as we dig into air quality concerns and environmental justice for communities in Wyandotte County. I'm D. Rashawn Gilmore, and as always, thank you for the pleasure of your time.